plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your real ID at tsa.gov/real ID. That's tsa.gov/real ID. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about the ever-so-elegant, full-of-love, Audrey Hepburn. Please stay tuned at the end of Audrey's story for my review of the week. Could it be yours? Wait and see. But first, Miss Audrey Hepburn. What image comes to your mind when you think of the name Audrey Hepburn? I think of perfection. I picture her in that iconic black dress and Breakfast at Tiffany's, adorned in pearls, a perfect not-a-hair-out-of-place updo, and those big black sunglasses. For a lot of people, especially today, that is probably about as much as they know about Audrey Hepburn. An image. But behind that image was a real woman who bore deep emotional scars, just like many others. And she grew into a woman that wasn't afraid to hang up that elegant dress and get her hands dirty. Audrey Kathleen Rustin was born in Brussels, Belgium on May 4, 1929, into an upper-class family. Her father, Joseph, was a successful banker, an aristocrat hopeful, and her mother, Ella, was of Dutch nobility. She was a baroness. Both of Audrey's parents had been married prior to their marriage to each other, and Ella had two sons from her first marriage. The boys were 6 and 9 years old by the time their mother had remarried and had Audrey, and they absolutely adored their little sister. Actually, this may be difficult to imagine given who Audrey Hepburn was in Hollywood, but she was quite a tomboy as a child. She wanted to do whatever her brothers were doing. As far as the Hepburn name, being of nobility, Ella urged her husband to incorporate that into their family name, so he could sound a little more important. He had believed that he was related to James Hepburn, the third husband of Mary, Queen of Scots, a belief that was later proved to be false. James Hepburn wasn't the most awesome guy in royal history to want to be attached to, but a royal is a royal. So Ella had supported them adding the name to further enhance their social ranking. Audrey's father's position at the bank took the family all over Europe, and as a result, Audrey was fluent in several languages at a very young age. The family lived in the lap of luxury, huge mansions wherever they happened to be living at the time. They were very well connected, very privileged, and wanted for nothing. But then, with the change in the political climate that was occurring in 1930s Europe, the happy family threads began to unravel. Both Joseph and Ella became members of the British Union of Fascists in London. They visited Berlin to attend Nazi marches, supported the idea of rejuvenation of Europe, and Ella even met Adolf Hitler himself at an event. And she loved him. Can you imagine? Don't worry, she changes her mind pretty quickly. Hitler had a lot of people wrapped around his ugly little finger with his very misconstrued promises. Audrey's mother Ella even wrote a few articles in local publications about her support of the Nazi Party. In one newspaper clipping I read, she wrote, quote, "The Germany of today is a most pleasant country, and the Germans under Nazi rule, a splendid example to the white races of the world. A mighty people, upright and proud, as indeed they have every right to be, end quote. Yikes. By the end of 1935, Joseph would disappear from the family. He walked out of the home one day and never returned. It's unclear exactly what the circumstances of Joseph's abandonment of his family were, but there are theories that Ella's father, Baron Van Heemstra, blackmailed Joseph to leave his daughter, and with him would go her support of fascism. That's just a theory out there, though. I think you'll see it's clear that he just didn't want to have a family. The separation of her parents became a clearly defined crack in Audrey's childhood. It was the moment her childhood went from happy, loving, and carefree to her feeling lonely, isolated, and unloved. After her parents separated, Audrey's mother moved to the Netherlands and Audrey was enrolled in school in Kent, all by herself. It was 6 months before Ella visited her daughter in Kent, who I should point out was only 6 years old. And Ella was horrified at the changes she saw in her daughter. Audrey was a shell of her former bubbly self. Audrey's parents' actions damaged their daughter so severely that her personality and lovely spirit had been locked away so deeply inside of her that she wouldn't be able to access it again for years. Thankfully, Ella saw her part in this emotionally traumatic experience that had caused such a change in her young daughter, so she moved to Kent to be close to Audrey. The little girl just needed love. Her whole world had been ripped apart the day her dad walked away. Not only was her father gone and her mother emotionally preoccupied, but she was immediately sent away, further digging in those feelings of being unwanted and unloved. With the war in Europe ramping up, in September of 1939, Ella took Audrey out of England and moved her to where she'd been living in the neutral Netherlands. Audrey's father returned briefly into her life, just long enough to bring her to the airport and say goodbye. I'm sure Audrey felt so much hope in this moment. But this was the last time she would see her father for decades. She was 10 years old. Audrey enrolled in school in the Netherlands, learned how to speak Dutch pretty quickly, and began taking ballet lessons. Things were smoothing out in Audrey's life, and she was adjusting very well to her new life without her father in a brand new country. But then, the Germans invaded Holland, the Netherlands, just 6 months after their move there. The port town of Rotterdam was bombed by a German air raid on May 10, 1940, and Nazi soldiers were soon occupying their town of Arnhem. Soon, Germany had occupied the entire country, and their once peaceful village was being patrolled by armored cars outfitted with machine guns. It was common for civilians to be shot on the street, right in front of whoever may be passing by. Audrey's grandfather's mansion was taken over by German soldiers. Everyone was essentially a prisoner of the SS. It was terrifying, as you can imagine. All of this affected 11-year-old Audrey in many ways. First of all, her mother insisted she begin going by Edda Van Heemstra to disassociate from the English-sounding name of Audrey. She didn't want any unwanted attention brought to her daughter. In school, some of Audrey's teachers disappeared from the classrooms. They were Jewish women. The curriculum and lesson plans were restructured to be supportive of Nazi ideals. Within local circles, Ella's previous support of fascism had become known and wasn't doing her any favors among the local community. But now, after living with the horrors of Nazi control, Ella took a big step back from those beliefs. As the war progressed and Audrey grew from a girl to a teenager, she began getting involved in the resistance movement. She delivered the underground newspaper, delivered messages and documents, delivered food to allies in hiding, volunteered at the local hospital, and performed ballet to raise money for the resistance. All potentially dangerous things to do, but she was going to help the innocent residents of her new country any way she could. She would flutter those big, beautiful eyes at Nazi soldiers and have them eating out of the palm of her hand, all to get past them with secret messages hidden in her shoes, putting her own life in danger to help others. Eventually, Audrey and her mother fled Arnhem and relocated to Ella's father's, the Baron's home, not far away. Life was very difficult throughout the entire war. There were food rations, no proper supplies, and constant worry and fear. But they were alive, they were home, and the three of them were together, which was a lot more than millions of other Europeans had the privilege of saying. Unfortunately, Audrey's family didn't come out of the war totally unscathed. One of her brothers had spent time in a Nazi work camp, and her uncle Otto had been executed for his involvement in the resistance movement. The worst part of the war, according to Audrey, was watching the trainfuls of Jewish people being taken away to their likely deaths. The worst, she said, was seeing the children. She never forgot the image of one boy in particular waiting with his parents to board the train and the innocence on his little face. "I was a child observing a child," she said. The image of these children, that boy in particular, would haunt her for the rest of her life. Audrey later recounted of living through World War II, quote, "Had we known that we were going to be occupied for 5 years, we might have all shot ourselves. We thought it might be over in a week, 6 months, next year. That's how we got through," end quote. I just want to take a minute to remind everyone to really take in these accounts we read of people who have lived through war and other horrendous events. I think it's much easier to live in denial of these things than face the reality of them. Knowing these stories is really beneficial in being more thankful and content people ourselves. I feel that we are such a modern society of give me, give me, give me that everyone just feels entitled to every luxury in the world simply because they want it. Stop and read these stories and really think about the tragedies so many people in our past and present have been forced to endure. A fight to just stay alive. I could not recommend the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor E. Frankl enough. He was a psychiatrist who survived life in Nazi concentration camps. And in this book, he lays out the very detailed horrors of fighting for survival every second of every day. And then he writes about how to take the good from that horror, the meaning of it all, the meaning of life. Parts of it, lots of it, actually, are really, really difficult to read. But I think we all need to know these horrors of our past. It's really, really inspiring. Knowing these things and revisiting these kinds of stories helps us be more humble ourselves. For me, at least. I know damn well how blessed I am, and I don't deserve any of it. And it could all disappear in a second. For any of us. Please pick up a copy of Man's Search for Meaning. It's so good. The war finally came to an end in 1945 after a long 5 years. The daily horrors were behind them, but now, like so many others, they were left to pick up the pieces and rebuild their lives. Audrey and her mother were alive. They had survived, and they were incredibly thankful for that. But Audrey was left extremely malnourished, and her body was really fighting to survive. She was a naturally thin person, very thin, but she was left to nothing after the war. She was jaundiced, anemic, and developed a severe respiratory infection. Her body was so weakened. She had a long road of recovery ahead of her to rebuild her strength. She actually came close to death, but cigarettes, of all things, saved her life. Not smoking them, that would definitely not be a good idea. A friend of her mother's was able to send thousands of cigarettes to them, which Ella sold on the black market. And then she used that money to pay for the penicillin needed to save her daughter's life. These two had survived war. They could do anything now. Audrey's brothers returned home after the war, and with their family wealth depleted, they moved to Amsterdam, and Ella and the young men had to get jobs, which wasn't something any of them had ever done before the war. They were nobility. They didn't work. Ella, who grew up very privileged, found a job as a housekeeper. She had never cleaned a thing in her life. She had no idea what she was doing. And she'd lived her whole life before the war, giving orders and being waited on hand and foot, not taking orders. Needless to say, the housekeeping gig didn't last too long. Luckily, she found a job that was much more suited for her personality and experience, flower shop manager. And from there, she worked at a hair salon. And while working at the salon in 1947, her 18-year-old daughter Audrey became a little entrepreneur when she started designing and making hats for her mother's clients, a prelude to her creative design spirit. It was also in this new life in Amsterdam where Audrey's hard work in ballet progressed to the next level. She began training under famed ballet instructor Sonia Gaskell. Audrey dreamed of a career in ballet. In 1948, 19-year-old Audrey Hepburn made her screen debut when she accepted a job in a Dutch travel film where she played a KLM flight attendant. Shortly after that little taste of on-screen action, Audrey was offered a ballet scholarship in London, so it was time to relocate once again. In London, she supported herself with some modeling and receptionist work while she worked tirelessly in her ballet studies. Unfortunately, she was eventually told that her height of 5'7", which was a bit on the taller side for a ballerina, and her still weakened body from the effects of the war would make it impossible for her to ever become a prima ballerina. This crushed her. This was her one dream. So, never to be defeated, she thought she would dabble in acting again. Audrey joined the line of hundreds of other beautiful young talent at a casting call for a musical called High Button Shoes at the Hippodrome Theatre in London. And she got a part as a chorus girl in the production. And then another production, and another. With each one, Audrey stood out from all of the other chorus girls. Everyone noticed her amongst the other women, and she had soon taken London by storm. "I plunged into show business in London," Audrey recalled. "It was the best cure ever." In 1950, at 22 years old, Audrey Hepburn first appeared in British Vogue, a publication that would soon fall in love with the soon-to-be style icon. And then she made the jump from the stage onto the big screen, appearing in both British and French films. And just as she was beginning to settle into this new life of mostly minor film roles, everything was about to change for her. The French author Colette, writer of the novel Gigi, had seen Audrey and was interested in her for the Broadway production of her story in 1953. She wanted Audrey Hepburn to play the lead role of Gigi. It was a very exciting opportunity. And then, as plans were being made for Audrey to go to America for the production, American film director William Wyler was in London looking for the perfect lead for his next movie, Roman Holiday. I think we all know who he found for the part. Audrey Hepburn would be perfect. For both projects, actually. One Broadway production in New York and one Hollywood film role in Rome. Audrey Hepburn was about to become a star. When Audrey Hepburn was introduced to American moviegoers in Roman Holiday in 1953, they were presented with something they'd never quite seen before. She was elegant, yet innocent. She was stunningly beautiful, yet there was something almost childlike about her presence. She carried herself with great grace and sophistication, thanks to her upper-class upbringing, very similar to Grace Kelly. Audrey Hepburn was an overnight star. When asked by a reporter if she had any advice to others on becoming such an instant sensation, she said, quote, "The only advice I can give is that they make sure they want to be it enough, because as it's so often said, hard work is never hard work when it's done with love," end quote. Audrey Hepburn won the Best Actress Oscar at the 1954 Academy Awards ceremony for her work in Roman Holiday. Audrey was thrust into nonstop movement, filming movies, publicity events, television interviews, and costume design. Her second film with Paramount was Sabrina with Humphrey Bogart, who was not a huge fan of his co-star. He had wanted his wife, Lauren Bacall, in the role, so he was a little bitter with Audrey Hepburn. Plus, let's admit it, they were quite different types of people, Bogey and Audrey Hepburn. It was during the production of Sabrina where Audrey Hepburn first became a true style icon. She teamed up with fashion designer Hubert de Givenchy to create her gowns for Sabrina, and the result was nothing short of perfection. That gorgeous white gown with the black embroidery in the movie is so stunning and beautiful. I love it. Audrey Hepburn and designer Hubert de Givenchy were an instant fashion match. They connected on an emotional and artistic level, and they would remain style collaborators for the rest of Audrey's life. Audrey Hepburn was his artistic muse, and together they invented the iconic Audrey Hepburn style and image. Audrey Hepburn's life was about to change in other ways, too. She was about to become a married woman. After filming Roman Holiday in Italy, co-star Gregory Peck skedaddled his way back to U.S. soil to tell his best friend, actor Mel Ferrer, that he had to meet this woman. The two hit it off and were married on September 25th, 1954, in Switzerland, where they were both preparing for a movie they would star in together, War and Peace. Those close to the couple said that they were a wonderful match. They were equals in their relationship, so on 1950s, and they respected each other greatly. The first movie I remember seeing Audrey Hepburn in was Funny Face with Fred Astaire, because I love Fred Astaire. This movie was released in 1957. Audrey Hepburn had a rich background in dance, mostly ballet, but she didn't think she was anywhere near Fred Astaire level of dance. She was terrified to dance with him. She said, quote, "I know how good I should be to dance with Fred Astaire, and I knew I wasn't. To be cast opposite him was terribly exciting, but I was very apprehensive," end quote. As if we'd expect anything less, it turned out beautifully. Now let's talk a little about Breakfast at Tiffany's, the movie that gave us that perfect Audrey Hepburn image I described at the beginning. Truman Capote had written the novel Breakfast at Tiffany's, and when casting began for the film adaptation, he was not thinking of an actress like Audrey Hepburn to fill the role of Holly Golightly. He wanted Marilyn Monroe, a bombshell type, not an elegant, innocent type. I think the casting call turned out perfectly. It would have just been an entirely different movie with Marilyn Monroe as Holly Golightly. Audrey Hepburn always yearned to be a mother. Ever since she was a little girl, she loved babies and wanted to have one of her own someday. I assume her emotionally scarring childhood left her with a desire to give a child the love they deserved and needed to. The love she never had. Audrey sadly suffered several miscarriages in her life, but she was delighted when she and Mel welcomed their son, Sean, into the world in June of 1960. She was so happy and loved her little boy more than anything in the world. She continued to work, juggling life as a working mother, but when Sean got to schooling age and was now gone from home attending school much of the time, those absences, combined with her absences from him for work, were too difficult to bear. So, still sitting at the height of fame, Audrey Hepburn stepped away from the spotlight to devote her life to her child. Her little boy came first. Her love for him was more important than anything else, and she was in a position to make that choice, so she did it. This decision shocked the world, but Audrey would have thrown away her entire career for her child. She was going to give her child all the love she had so desperately wanted when she herself was a child. Audrey Hepburn stayed out of movies for 10 whole years, devoting her everything to being the best mother she could be. The world had fallen in love with the image of Audrey Hepburn, and she definitely had such a specific Audrey Hepburn image. But behind that perfectly curated public image, there was a real woman. And we must remember that woman was a real child who lived through real horror and trauma. And she turned that trauma into good. She learned from it and became a really good person. She was a multidimensional woman, not the slightly shy image of a statuesque woman that most thought of. And everyone who knew her said she was so down to earth, so real, just so lovely. She was outrageously famous and seemingly unreachable, but when her friends were with her, her presence was so calming that they forgot they were amongst one of the most famous people in the world. Audrey Hepburn was also a bit timid and very self-conscious, emotionally fragile in many ways. Her mother wasn't the most loving woman in the world. In fact, I read that she criticized her daughter more than praised her. So that, coupled with her father's abandonment, really left some deep marks on her emotionally. She said of herself, quote, "Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and this is something I can't see. I see the problems when I get up in the morning, and I do my best to look well. I would have liked to have not been so tall. I would have liked to have had smaller feet. I'd like to have had more figure. I'd like to have had a smaller nose. I'd like to have been blonde. I'd like to have changed everything." End quote. Here was Audrey Hepburn, the most perfectly beautiful, perfectly presented, most fashionably iconic woman in the world. And she only saw imperfection in herself. Isn't that so sad? Please, everyone, praise your children and grandchildren. I cannot stress this enough. Highlight their strengths as much as you can and choose your words carefully when guiding them through the trials of their life. Tell them they are bright and beautiful and strong. Support them and encourage them. Please don't belittle them or point out nothing but their flaws, because how we treat our children can very, very deeply affect them as adults in both remarkable ways and devastating ways. To add on to Audrey's sense of feeling not good enough, her husband, Mel, had become somewhat demanding and difficult. That perfect equal union that they had in the beginning of their marriage was fading away. They worked together so much, too, and I think this can really impact a romantic relationship. Not too many couples can pull that off and make it through the other side as happy and in love as they were the day they met. I mean, I love my husband more than anything in the world, but I definitely don't want to work with him. So the spark started to fizzle out in the relationship of Audrey and Mel. She was still just searching and yearning for that love and want from a man that she lost the day her father walked away from her as a small child. In her marriage, she eventually felt that disappointment again. The unlove. This emotional experience of her marriage showing some cracks urged her to set out and find her father, once and for all. She needed to find her father. The Red Cross helped her locate him in 1964. He was living in Ireland. He surely knew that his daughter had become a global sensation, a huge movie star. But there he was, just living life in Ireland. So Audrey Hepburn packed her bags, and with her husband Mel at her side, she flew to Ireland to come face to face with her father. She didn't ask him all of the questions that had been haunting her through her entire life. She didn't demand a single thing from him. She just needed to see him and know that he was there. I think what she really wanted was for him to have an emotional reunion with her, to embrace her and cry apologies at her. But he didn't do that. He was emotionally cold to her. And I saw two photographs of them from this reunion, and his face just screams, "Get this BS over with." She is leaning into him in these photos, and he is leaning away. This did not help Audrey Hepburn's emotional state regarding love and acceptance. What a jerk. And to top it off, Audrey supported her father financially for the rest of his life. She owed this man nothing, but she had a big, loving heart. Audrey and Mel's marriage ended in 1968 after 14 years of marriage. Their son Sean was 8 years old when his parents divorced. Mel Farer would spend the rest of his life full of regret. Audrey found love again pretty quickly. She met an Italian doctor named Andrea Dotti through mutual friends shortly after her divorce from Mel. It was another chance at love for her. They married in January of 1969 when Audrey was 39 years old, and she and Sean moved to Rome to start their new life together with Andrea. Just over a year later, Audrey gave birth to her second son, Luca. Audrey was elated to have another child to smother with love. As for her marriage, though, well, Andrea wasn't the most devoted man in the world. This poor woman just wanted love and respect from a man, and nobody seemed to be able to completely give that to her. Andrea had a, quote, complicated personality, and was known to party the night away with other women, oftentimes much younger women. I want to share a passage I heard in Audrey's own voice about her struggles in love, because I just found it so very sad. She said, "Your heart just breaks, that's all. Men are human beings with all the frailties women have. Perhaps they are more vulnerable than women. I think you can hurt a man so easily. You cannot judge, you cannot point fingers, you cannot put anybody in a mold. You've just got to be lucky enough to find somebody who you can satisfy, and then who pleases you if you're lucky." I'm going to read that last part again. "You've just got to be lucky enough to find somebody who you can satisfy, and then who pleases you if you're lucky." That Audrey Hepburn thought this way, and I'm sure many, many other women who were disrespected the way she was. Oh, it just breaks my heart. She tried so hard to make her husbands happy, to satisfy them, and she thought she was the one who failed. And yes, you can judge and you can point fingers. Especially to somebody who made vows to you and then stomps on you over and over again. It was a different time. Audrey held on to her marriage as long as she emotionally could, just as she had with her first marriage to Mel. She wanted to avoid that heart-wrenching heartache as long as possible. But staying in the marriage was heartache enough. She was lonely, defeated, and sad. The marriage ended in 1982 after 13 years. Audrey left Rome after her marriage ended and she moved to Switzerland. She left the constant Italian paparazzi. She left the sad memories. She left her past. She left it all to start a new life once again. She was always forced to start a new life. Audrey sought peace in Switzerland. She wanted peace and calm and simple and quiet and ordinary. And she found it. She was able to have all of that in Switzerland. And she also found the love she'd always deserved. As the last layers of her marriage to Andrea shed away into the wind, Audrey met actor Robert Wolders. She remained with him for the rest of her life. With him, she found love, affection, devotion, and best of all, safety. All of the things that she'd yearned for her entire life, since the day her father walked out of the door and out of her life. Audrey Hepburn, in her early 50s, had finally found true love. And he was quite a hottie, if I do say so myself. Much better looking than Andrea, who could have been Andy Kaufman's twin brother. Not that appearance is all that matters, but it sure doesn't hurt, right? She also stepped into humanitarian work during this new chapter of her life. I'm going to try not to cry, but I cried so hard and so often writing this part of the script. After speaking at an event about her experiences during World War II, she was asked to become a Goodwill Ambassador for UNICEF in 1988. Yes, she loved her quiet and simple life in Switzerland, but if she could help children, she was going to help children. "For children, I'd go to the moon," she said. Audrey Hepburn, the little girl who always wanted to have babies and to be a mother, was now able to share all of her heart with so many children around the world who really needed it. She helped the children, and she helped herself. Her humanitarian work, it turned out, was exceptionally therapeutic for her, too. This is my absolute favorite part of Audrey Hepburn's story. I love children so much, and I am a strong advocate for the positive well-being and health of children. And the fact that Audrey Hepburn devoted this chapter of her life to children in need, it's just so admirable. It was really difficult for me to read and watch the portions of my source materials about Audrey's work with children. I cried. I would have to stop, and then I would cry again. It took a while to get through. It was heartbreaking. And in footage of her with UNICEF, you can see the devastation on Audrey's face too. You can see her holding back tears, being strong for the children. This was hard work. Emotionally crippling work. Work that most people would choose to avoid for their own emotional protection. But not Audrey Hepburn. She said, quote, "To enter a food center for children, to smell the death, seeing the corpses being taken away." I'm sorry, I just can't get through this part. Those tiny faces, it's unbearable. To see small children just die in front of your eyes because they're starving. It is just so totally unacceptable. End quote. She watched children die. She held small children as they gasped for air and took their last breaths. Audrey took a stand. She went in front of the U.S. Congress and requested money for the impoverished countries that she had volunteered her time in, where she saw the devastation of children starving to death. And she secured $60 million to help. Not to mention the money raised by UNICEF thanks to Audrey Hepburn's promotion of their causes. Audrey Hepburn helped women and children in Ethiopia, Turkey, Ecuador, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Bangladesh, Sudan, and Vietnam. She helped with polio vaccines. She helped train women and children. She worked in schools. She delivered clean drinking water. She produced literacy programs. She assisted in nutrition initiatives. She did whatever was needed of her. Maybe most importantly, though, she provided comfort. Audrey Hepburn was a selfless woman, especially when she continued to work in these harsh conditions with UNICEF, even after she began experiencing stomach pains. The pains worsened, yet she continued to help the children. It was cancer. Audrey Hepburn's body was overtaken quickly by the cancer spreading through her body. There was barely time to accept the disease and plan for whatever the future held. It was too late. Audrey Hepburn, war survivor, ballerina, fashion icon, screen goddess, humanitarian, and beholder of a huge, genuine heart, died on January 20th, 1993. She was only 63 years old and had so much more love and compassion to give the world. Now, I would like to share some other interesting things I learned about the wonderful Audrey Hepburn during my research. Bullet point number one, Audrey Hepburn won the Triple Crown of Acting, an Oscar, an Emmy, and a Tony. Bullet point number two, the white gown I love so much from Sabrina, well, it landed in the personal collection of Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher for a while. And in 2017, it was auctioned off for $217,600. Bullet point number three. Probably the most iconic dress of Audrey Hepburn's, the famous black dress from Breakfast at Tiffany's, also sold for a pretty penny at auction. A very pretty penny. $920,000 in 2006. Bullet point number four. After accepting her first and only Oscar for Roman Holiday, she accidentally lost the Oscar for a few minutes. She forgot it in the bathroom. Luckily, it was still there when she rushed back to retrieve it. A Hollywood newbie mistake, I'm sure. Bullet point number 5. President George H.W. Bush presented Audrey Hepburn with the Presidential Medal of Freedom in December of 1992 for her outstanding work with UNICEF. She was too ill to attend the ceremony. She died just a few weeks later. Bullet point number 6. Audrey Hepburn donated every cent of her film and television projects while working with UNICEF to UNICEF. She wasn't in it for the publicity, just appearing in a few shots for the world to see and not really doing the work. She was doing the hard work and giving money to help children in need. She really cared. In conclusion, Audrey Hepburn may be known mostly for her perfectly curated, stunning image during the 1950s. But there was so, so, so much more to this beautiful woman. She was abandoned by her father as a child, and for the most part, abandoned by him all over again after she tracked him down as an adult. She never really had a home. She survived the horrors of war. She almost died from the malnutrition and disease that she sustained during World War II. She achieved overnight stardom. She found love. She had her heart shattered. She reconstructed her heart one piece at a time and had it shattered all over again. She loved fiercely and forever sought that kind of love in return. In her children, she got that. Audrey Hepburn had a very complex life full of the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. She learned survival at a very young age, and she used the strength she gained there to endure all the pain that came her way throughout her life. She deserved none of that pain, but she didn't come through it with bitterness or resentment. She came through with love, strength, hope, and a strong admiration for life. She took the brutality of life and turned it into positivity and love. And she shared that love with those who needed it the most. The starving and impoverished children all over the world. Audrey Hepburn's selfless work with UNICEF is the most admirable aspect of her entire rich life. After living a life of survival, hard work, and giving herself to others, she had finally found the solace she so desperately wanted. She was ready to live out the remainder of her days in her peaceful farmhouse in Switzerland, taking a long exhale from the nonstop life she'd just settled in from. But when asked to help children who didn't have a speck of food to eat or a drop of clean water to drink, there was no way Audrey could comfortably sit in her beautiful Swiss home. She had to help. And from that moment on, she devoted her life to children in need. Audrey Hepburn's story is a love story, maybe not in the fairy tale sense we may be used to. But Audrey's love was ripped away as a child, and she searched her whole life for that kind of love. She could never really find that love that was taken from her. And then there it was. It was in the tiny, innocent faces of the children she held and fed and comforted. This was the love that she had been chasing. No other kind of love could ever compare to the love she felt when she held a dying child in her arms. It was the purest kind of love. Audrey Hepburn's style was timeless, and her love was selfless. Thank you, Audrey Hepburn, for everything you gave to the world. Thank you for enduring the terrors of war and coming through the other side ready to spread a positive attitude and a message of hope. But most of all, thank you for helping the children. If you would like to help the children of our world, please consider making a donation to UNICEF. For the price one sandwich costs these days in a casual restaurant, you could help feed a dozen or more children. You can also give Inspired Gifts, which is a program they have that I love. You can choose which area of need you would like to support, like medical or education, and then you choose specifically what kind of help you'll be providing. For instance, you can fully vaccinate a child for life for a pledge of $58. You can provide essential newborn kits for 20 babies for $186. You can supply 350 malnutrition detection bands for $7. I've done this a few times because I love this innovation and it's so easy to help. You can provide warm blankets for 5 children for $32. You can provide 5 children with backpacks for just $13. You can outfit an entire school with pencils for $30. Even things you may not consider, things that are really a luxury to most of us, like menstruation products for teenage girls. It's a really, really awesome support program they offer at UNICEF. I donate monthly, and I know my money is going to really, really good causes. When I think about my donations to causes, you know, I'm not made of money and I haven't stumbled across any money trees yet. I always stop to think, remember the stupid stuff that you spend money on all the time. Those one-click purchases on Amazon that you don't really need. Remember how much you spend on one cup of coffee. Remember how easily you throw over $100 to a restaurant for a meal for two. I can afford to help others. Ask yourself if you can too. You can donate at unicef.org. That's UNICEF.org. To go directly to the Inspired Gifts menu, visit market.unicefusa.org. Okay, that was an emotionally wild ride. Now it's review time. This week, I would like to share a review from user JLN93 on Spotify. They said, "You have the most unique voice. It's different, yes, but that's what makes you unique to listen to. I love your content, I love your presentation, I love your research, and I love your passion. Keep up the good work." A little retaliation at the person that said they didn't like my voice. I love it. Thank you so much, JLN93. As far as that research, I am engrossed in podcast research pretty much every free moment of my life. And you know what? It's not a hindrance. Quite the contrary. In this modern world full of so much hate, nastiness, inconsideration for others, and a world overtaken by social media and now AI influence, I hate AI, it is such a welcoming opportunity to be able to step back in time and live vicariously through these lives that I get to dive into. It makes living in today's world a little more bearable. I've said it before, but I grew up with a historian, my dad. So I think a love of yesterday is just in my blood. I've always loved old movies and television shows way more than anything current through my entire life. And the grace in which people carried themselves in the first half of the 20th century was just very admirable. People dressed well all the time, opposed to the pajama-clad Walmart shoppers of today. People lived simple, happy lives. And best of all, people were kind to each other. They had manners. People don't have manners anymore. So all of that said, it's really refreshing to step back in time and experience those things that are so lost to society, and unfortunately, I don't think are ever coming back. And I'm beyond happy to share everything I learn with you all each week. Thanks again, Spotify listener JLN93, and thank you all so much for listening to the show. My goal is to grow enough in the next couple years where I can put even more time and research into the show and share even more fun content. I do have some really great ideas. I even have an idea for a second show, but I barely have enough time to put this one out, so that will have to remain a dream for now. But the more listeners I have, the greater chance those dreams may become a reality. So thank you all so much. If you want to hear your review or comment of the show, please leave one where you listen to your podcasts or a comment on my posts on Facebook or Instagram. And maybe I'll read yours in an upcoming episode. Even if it's bad, I'll read it and promise to be nice about it. And these reviews also really help with show discoverability, so it's very helpful. One more thing, and then I will let you go, I promise. I just want to remind everyone that I'm now releasing 2 episodes with the same content. I'm dabbling into the world of background and transition music to add a little more emotional effect to my stories. So Tuesdays will be the release of those episodes with some music in them. But if you are sensitive to podcasts with music incorporated in them, like I am releasing the same content with no music added on Wednesdays. They are labeled as sensory sensitive. The only music in those will be the intro and outro, just like all of the episodes up until recently. So you can choose your own adventure as far as that goes. And hopefully I'll get a little better with this whole music thing as we go along, because I have no clue what I'm doing. For this episode, I used a book titled Audrey Hepburn, A Life from Beginning to End, part of the Hourly History series. I also used a phenomenal documentary titled Audrey, which is available on Netflix. Highly recommend watching it. UNICEF at unicef.org and IMDb.